in this case, to try to liquidate the question of Western Sahara.
Thank you for that, Mr. Magama.
The African Union is concerned about foreign military bases on the continent, as this goes against the concept of African solutions to African problems. In a bid to discourage foreign forces from setting base in the continent, the African Union is engaged in regional efforts to combat terrorism. Ambassador Fatima Mohammed, the permanent observer of the African Union to the United Nations, elaborates here on regional efforts to combat terrorism in Africa.
The African Union peace support operations and ad hoc security coalitions have also significantly degraded the capabilities of some of the terrorist groups in the different sub-regions. At the national level, the criminal justice response to terrorism have also been strengthened with the adoption of the anti-terrorism legislation and the enhanced capacities of law enforcement agencies. There are also growing efforts by our member states to better understand and address the political, social, and economic situation and conditions that make it conducive for the spread of violent ideologies.
Our last question to you, Mr. Magama, now. Can African countries defeat terrorism without interference by Western military powers, especially the U.S.?
We know that the terrorism that we face on the African continent, was sponsored and in many instances still continues to be sponsored by very close allies of the United States in the Middle East. And so, their attempt to purely look at a military solution to what clearly is a situation that cannot be resolved merely by the military, is of course a manifestation or a witness to the United States approach to issues of national security. I mean, if you are a hammer or all you have is a hammer, of course, everything looks like a nail. And so that has been the U.S.'s approach to issues of global insecurity, without taking a comprehensive view of the root causes and other socioeconomic issues that might be underlying the terrorism.
Well, you have it there. The military approach being imposed by the U.S. on African countries cannot eliminate terrorism in the continent. Thank you for that insight, Mr. Magama, a former member of the South African Parliament. Now, we shall take a short break, and when we come back, our guest will give an analysis on the scramble for the Horn of Africa. Don't go away.
Scramble for the Horn of Africa.
The Horn of Africa, a region that basically includes Eritrea, Djibouti, Somalia, and Ethiopia, is of great importance to regional and global powers due to its geopolitical and strategic considerations. Now, this region is now an epicenter of foreign military presence in Africa, with at least 13 foreign military bases.
Djibouti, a tiny Horn of Africa nation, plays host to naval bases of world and regional powers from the United States, Japan, France, Italy, Spain, and most recently China and Saudi Arabia. In 2017, China opened its first overseas military base in Djibouti. A Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson explains here on the importance of the base.
The base will help China to better fulfill its international obligation in Somali waters, such as carrying out escort missions and providing humanitarian aid. It will also benefit Djibouti in social and economic development and enable China to make further contribution in safeguarding peace and stability in Africa and the world.
The U.S. also recently appointed its first ever special envoy to the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman. Now, this led to fears that the region is set for more destabilizing moves by the U.S. and its allies. For more analysis on the apparent scramble for the Horn of Africa, we have contacted Lawrence Freeman, a political economic analyst for Africa. Thank you for your time, Mr. Freeman.
You're welcome.
Now, our first question to you. The United States has appointed a special envoy for the Horn of Africa. What's the real reason behind this appointment, and should we expect more meddling in the region by Washington?
But the situation in the Horn of Africa is very important strategically to the United States and to the West as a whole. Ethiopia has been a very strong ally of the United States for many decades, both on the Republican and Democratic presidential administrations. And Special Envoy Feldman now has made a trip to the region, will be making another trip. And unfortunately, he's acting against the interest of the United States, which unfortunately is the policy of the United States. They have now turned against Ethiopia for the moment, a long-standing ally. And the special envoy, following the policy of the Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, is not playing a helpful role in the region.
Now, early June, Saudi Arabia's foreign minister met Jeffrey Feltman in Riyadh. UAE's foreign minister also met Feltman to coordinate Horn of Africa strategies. Now, Mr. Freeman, as we have seen, Feltman recently visited some Persian Gulf monarchies. What roles are these countries playing in advancing Washington's interest in the Horn of Africa?
The Biden administration has adopted this view that the U.S. will impose a democracy dictatorship and human rights dictatorship on countries throughout the world, and is trying to force countries to behave in a way that they find acceptable to their view of liberal democracy. Unfortunately, this is having a very bad effect. The situation in Ethiopia is very difficult, and the U.S. is playing a very bad role at points by weakening the administration of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. They have a history of ethnic tensions where the government in Addis Ababa is struggling against various groups of ethno-nationalists to preserve the nation state. And some of the actions by the United States are actually weakening the government and weakening the nation.
The presence of rival foreign military bases in Djibouti has led to mutual accusation, especially between the U.S. and China. For instance, in 2018, the Pentagon claimed Chinese nationals pointed lasers at U.S. military aircraft in Djibouti. China's defense ministry said the U.S. accusations were false.
This activity poses a true threat to our airmen. We have formally demarched the Chinese government, and we've requested that the Chinese investigate these incidents.
After strict verification, we have told the U.S. side that what they alleged is absolutely untrue.
Djibouti is the only nation hosting both U.S. and Chinese military bases. So is there any danger that these two superpowers will face off in this strategic Horn of Africa state?
Trump used Africa and made his foreign policy in Africa through John Bolton, his national security advisor, to stop China, counter China in Africa. The Biden administration is also out to stop China and counter China's efforts, and is taking a slightly different approach, but the intent is the same, that both the Trump and the Biden administrations suffer from the disease of geopolitics. They don't want to conceive of a world where countries are working together for the development of all people and all nations. They view the world as a zero-sum game. So if China is making progress in developing its economy and helping other economies, that is seen as a danger to those who follow the idiocy of geopolitics. And therefore, the Chinese must be kept down according to geopolitical doctrine. This is the same view Trump administration has. It's the same view the Biden administration has. So yes, Africa can become a chessboard for warfare by the United States against China.
Ethiopia, the largest Horn of Africa country, has been experiencing internal instability and is also involved in a dispute with neighboring Sudan and Egypt over its construction of a giant dam on the Nile. Now, Egypt's President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi says his country's share of the Nile River waters are untouchable in a stark warning apparently to Ethiopia, which is filling a giant new dam on the Nile's main tributary.
No one can take a single drop of water from Egypt, and whoever wants to try it, let them try. I'm not threatening anyone here. Our dialogue is always reasonable and rational. No one can take a drop from Egypt's water, and if it happens, there will be inconceivable instability in the region.
Now, the Ethiopia dam dispute is threatening to ignite more instability in the Horn of Africa region. How are foreign powers fueling this dispute?
The Gerd Dam, which is in the process of a second filling, is not a danger to any country. The water will pass through the turbines and return to the Nile. None of the water is being taken for agriculture or any other development, unlike the Nile water in Egypt, which is. There is no danger. This is an effort which we saw in the Trump administration and the Biden administration, even though they say they disagree with Trump on everything, are doing the same stupid thing that Trump did, which is they're trying to intervene to pressure Ethiopia to give in to Egypt because they want Egypt as a political player to use in their brinkmanship with Hamas and the Palestinian Authority, which Egypt has a way of conducting dialogue with them, and Israel. Sudan has no reason to object to the dam, except it's being blackmailed to do so.
Somalia has one of the most protracted conflicts in Africa. This Horn of Africa nation has been torn apart by civil war since 1992, when clan-based warlords overthrew a dictator. The country is now gripped by deadly attacks perpetrated by Al-Shabaab Takfiri terrorists. Somalia has accused foreign countries, including U.S. allies such as the United Arab Emirates, of destabilizing the country.
The monitoring group further stated that the establishment of a foreign military base in Berbera involving the transfer of military material to the territory will constitute a violation of arms embargo on Somalia.
Now, Mr. Freeman, my last question to you. What are the reasons for the continued destabilization of Somalia, a major Horn of Africa state?
The overall policy that the U.S. has for the Horn of Africa is absent of any concept of economic growth. The situation in Somalia is one of the poorest undeveloped countries in Africa. There are other countries like that. And what they have needed, the overall situation of the Horn of Africa, because of its strategic location in the Gulf of Aden along the Indian Ocean, because of the growth of Al-Shabaab and other extremist violent groups, that should be one of development. Ethiopia has 110 million people. Most of these people are poor. The majority of these people have no electricity. That's the same situation in Somalia. We should treat the region as a regional concern and promote a policy where we actually bring the people in Ethiopia and Somalia out of poverty. If you eliminate poverty and you eliminate hunger, you can bring stability to the region, and that's what our policy should be.
Mr. Freeman there says elimination of poverty will restore stability in the Horn of Africa region. Thanks a lot, Mr. Freeman, and unfortunately our time is up for today. On behalf of my colleagues here, I would like to thank you all. Have a great time and goodbye for now.
the limelight.
Both Haiti and Cuba for decades have been subjected to actions and policies from the United States and others, both overt and covert, which have undermined self-determination and economic independence at every conceivable juncture. We now present you an article written by Richard Sudan, a journalist, writer, and television reporter. The piece is titled, U.S. Must Get Its Own House in Order, Quit Meddling in Other Nations' Affairs. Over the last few days, U.S. President Joe Biden and his administration have reiterated statements following purported protests in Cuba and the assassination of the former Haitian president, Jovenel Moïse. Joe Biden's administration has suggested they're ready to offer support and help Haiti, if necessary, in the form of U.S. troops. Meanwhile, the White House has also claimed, incredibly, that the U.S. government stands with the people of Cuba. For anyone with a remote understanding of history, these statements at best represent a government completely out of touch with reality, and at worst, betray a much more nefarious purpose behind the U.S. issuing words of support for both countries. Both Haiti and Cuba for decades have been subjected to actions and policies from the United States, both overt and covert, which have undermined self-determination and economic independence at every conceivable juncture. Outside of the United States, very few believe the notion that troops would be sent to other countries for any other reason than to promote American interests. The people of Cuba have been subjected to a blockade and sanctions by the United States for more than six decades, as well as dealing with multiple attempts over the years to undermine the country on a number of levels. Haiti, too, has continued to be punished and weakened by many nations, including the United States of America, ever since the nation produced perhaps the greatest victory against colonialism in recorded history, following the slave rebellion of 1804, which defeated the strongest forces of empire in the world. Neocolonialism has continued to be a tactic against the country ever since, as a price paid for freedom and in becoming the first nation to completely eradicate slavery. When comparing this record with the many examples of crisis and turmoil within the United States itself, the backward sense of priorities and hypocrisy becomes even clearer. And in an ever-evolving global landscape, the whole world sees it. Recently in New York, serious flooding revealed that the city, which is perhaps one of the richest in the world, has serious and long-standing issues with infrastructure. While the conversation is rightly centered around concerns over climate change, the impact of Storm Elsa revealed the neglect and vulnerability of services upon which millions of ordinary people depend. New York's subways were flooded, resulting in perhaps some of the poorest sections of the working class being presented with a choice of either wading waist-deep into filthy, polluted, and dangerous water, or potentially compromising and jeopardizing their employment or family commitments. While many on the social media expressed sympathy for New Yorkers, others mocked the situation, suggesting that they themselves would never risk walking through littered subway water. But that's the point. Surely no one would take such a decision unless they had next to no choice. In a city which is home to some of the most affluent people and powerful institutions in the world, some of the most marginalized residents seem to have been abandoned to the mercy of extreme conditions that no one should be forced to navigate. Local emergency workers stepped in like heroes, but those too are ordinary people. The scene of the flooding, like everything, had been politicized by some seeking political power. And of course, people would argue that the scenes in New York City are a localized issue. But while the floods and extreme weather have revealed quite literal cracks in America's infrastructure, a plethora of other problems reveal a country deep in crisis and on a number of levels. While, of course, Joe Biden won the presidential election last November, he won it by a narrow margin. The defeat of Donald Trump did not smash the forces that produced him on both the right and the left. His administration's subsequent pandering to unfounded fears about immigration, especially the visit by Vice President Kamala Harris to Guatemala, in which she told potential migrants don't come to the United States, reflects the fact that racism and nationalism is as present as ever in the country. The plague of anti-black racism and policing is arguably getting worse, also symptomatic of white supremacy and deep-seated racism, which will not simply be undone with a few political gestures here and there. And just like in the United Kingdom, the chasm between the richest in society and the poorest is as wide as ever, with some of the richest cities failing to house and safeguard the poorest people. The floods in New York City might be a result of hyper-capitalism and ultimately global capitalism with regards to the environmental crisis. But there are many more symptoms of the underlying cause of the latest catastrophe. So while the US government postures and issues statements about other countries, quite simply, there are a long list of problems at home to work through. Rather than feigning support and so-called statements of solidarity for other countries, often in turmoil in part because of the military adventurism of the United States, the White House, with all of the power it possesses, needs to focus on fixing the never-ending list of problems within its own borders, not least for the sake of its own citizens and its global credibility.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, compassion and forgiveness. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Chapter Al-A'raf of Quran, verse number 199 says, practice forgiveness. It expresses the concept of forgiveness and compassion, which is one of the basic principles of the religion of Islam. When we look at the Islamic history, we can see clearly how Muslims established this important precept of the moral teaching of the Quran in their social life. At every point in their advance, Muslims destroyed unlawful practices and created a free and compassionate environment. In the area of religion, language, and culture, they made it possible for people totally opposite to each other to live under the same roof in freedom and peace, thereby giving those subject to them the advantages of knowledge, wealth, and position. Brothers and sisters, this concept of coexistence and tolerance, it is so essential and important for a believer that when we see the plight of today's world, we sometimes feel that it's gotten to a hopeless point. You know, the white supremacy and then discrimination based on nationality, discrimination based on color, discrimination based on race, all of those problems, right? This is the gift of the modern era that we are facing today. If you look at Muslims, alhamdulillah, throughout the history, we have a bright and luminous history. Look at Palestine, for example, as a case study. Christians, the Jewish, the Muslims, they all lived there when Muslims were controlling this region and this area. But as soon as the Zionist entity of Israel comes into the picture, look what Palestinians have been going through for over 70 years now. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are talking about compassion and forgiveness. And all, you know, the things that we talked about before the break, they show that the moral teaching offered to humanity by Islam is one that will bring peace, happiness, and justice to the world. The horror that is happening in the world today in the name of Islam is far away from the moral teachings of Quran. It is the work of ignorant, bigoted people, criminals who have nothing to do with religion. Because when we talk about what we discussed before the break, some people come around and say, what about ISIS, right? What about Boko Haram and such organizations and notorious outfits? They're operating in the name of Islam, right? Well, you all have to understand and realize this, dear and respected listeners. The Western imperialist agenda is being executed at the hands of Zionists and Takfiris. This is what we are facing. These organizations, these outfits, so to speak, like ISIS, you know, Daesh and Boko Haram and so on and so forth, you can see it clearly that they're not following Islam. They never have followed Islam. And they're not working for Islam. They don't work under any Islamic leadership, right? When you look at the heinous crimes that they create and the funding and the support that they get from the Western governments, the plot is very obvious for those who want to see. You look at the Zionists, you know, who's funding the Zionists? You look at the Takfiris and these ISIS terrorists, who's funding them, who's supporting them, who's providing them with political immunity? So do you think the West would provide them immunity and provide them with resources because they want to strengthen Islam? That's like a joke. These are the failed projects of the Western imperialist ideology and agenda. So remember that point, and hopefully that clears up your confusion. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
The raging wildfires are stoked by a wave of exceptional temperatures across the United States western region, combined with a prolonged drought that has desiccated vegetation. Western United States has grown warmer and drier in recent decades as a result of the climate crisis, accelerating the wildfires and making the job of controlling them more difficult. We're prepared for you an article written jointly by Ed Pilkington and Gabrielle Cannon. The piece is titled Western US and Canada Brace for Another Heat Wave as Wildfires Spread. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Fourth searing heat wave in 5 weeks is set to strike western United States and Canada in the coming days, aggravating wildfires that are already ravaging an area larger than Rhode Island, as drought and record-breaking temperatures tied to the climate crisis pummel the region. According to the National Interagency Fire Center, the impending heat wave comes as 12 states are already battling 71 active wildfires. The combined area of the blazes is about 1,553 square miles, that is 4,021 square kilometers. The largest blaze by far continues to be the Bootleg Fire in south-central Oregon, which has been burning for 9 days now and has devastated an area larger than New York City, with no sign of letting up. As of Thursday morning, 15th of July, the fire was at only 7% containment, and the cause remained unknown. Almost 2,000 houses are currently threatened by the Bootleg wildfire. Tim McCarley described to the Associated Press having to flee his home in a rural area north of Bly. He said the sheriff's department had been there and they said, if you don't get out of here right now, then you're going to die. He added, we were running around like a chicken with a head cut off, throwing stuff into the car. Then we say, okay, that's it, we've got to go. They evacuated from the flames, which came within just 5 feet or 1.5 meters of their house. Several large wildfires are also burning across Northern California, including the Dixie Fire, which erupted on Wednesday, 14th of July, and has grown to more than 2,250 acres, close to where the deadly 2018 campfire tore through the town of Paradise, remains at 0% containment. Lynette Round, an information officer with California Fire, said, it's a lot of steep and inaccessible terrain, and that's making it really difficult to get containment. She added, ground crews have to hike in, so it is a lot of work for the firefighters. Early hours of Wednesday, 14th of July, the fire raced along the steep terrain about 10 miles or 16 kilometers from the town of Paradise in Northern California. The current fire, which erupted in the rugged Feather River Valley, northeast of the town of Paradise, has not advanced towards it, and residents have not been ordered to evacuate their homes. Larry Peterson, whose home in neighboring Magalia survived the previous blaze, said some of his neighbors were getting their belongings together in case they had to flee the region. He told KHSL-TV, anytime you've got a fire after what we went through and another one is coming up, you've got to be concerned. Other local residents stocked up on water and other items. Jennifer Uni of the town of Paradise said, we pretty much left with our clothes on our backs during the previous wildfire. She added, so this time we're looking to be more prepared and more vigilant. Joyce McLean's home burnt last time, but she rebuilt it and would again rebuild if necessary. McLean said, we just take each day as it comes and if it happens. She added, there's not much that we can do about it. Bill Connolly told the Sacramento Bee Daily, because little of the foliage has grown back in the area since the 2018 Paradise blaze, there is nothing there now for the current wildfire to burn, the Butte County supervisor. While in Mariposa County in California, the river fire was brought to 36% containment after destroying 5 structures and burning through 9,500 acres of land. Evacuation orders were lifted as crews worked to mop up hotspots, but officials warned that years of drought and disease have weakened many trees, and those dead and down trees and logs continue to pose problems. The number of acres burnt in California this year is already eclipsing the number by this time last year, which also set a state record. By the end of 2020, roughly 4.1 million acres of land had been scorched in California. Lynette Round, an information officer with California Fire, said, last year was quite an anomaly in August, when we had over 14,000 lightning strikes that caused multiple wildfires at one time. Hopefully that does not happen again this year. She added, but what we are seeing this year is we didn't have as much rainfall, and that makes the fuels more susceptible to burning. The raging wildfires are stoked by a wave of exceptional temperatures across Western United States region, combined with a prolonged drought that has desiccated vegetation. Western United States has grown warmer and drier in recent decades as a result of the climate crisis, accelerating the wildfires and making the job of controlling them even more difficult. More than 60% of the Western United States is suffering exceptional or extreme drought right now, the highest rating since the authorities began monitoring the phenomena 20 years ago. Temperatures have also reached historic levels, with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the NOAA, marking 585 all-time records in the past 30 days. Emphasizing that residents in the area must remain vigilant, Round said, "When we have heat waves like this, we're always concerned." Writing in the Washington Post, meteorologist Matthew Cappucci said the next punishing heat wave is expected to start in the coming days and reach a critical peak by the next 10 days. It will be centered on a swath of the Rocky Mountains in the United States and up into Canada, bringing temperatures up to 30 degrees Fahrenheit above the average for this time of the year. Meteorologist Matthew Cappucci predicted, in addition to the hot temperatures, the sultry air mass will spare additional wildfire growth and ignite across western United States, where dozens of wildfires are currently burning. Satellite imagery posted on Twitter by the National Weather Service showed four giant clouds forming over the Bootleg wildfire, with the southernmost starting to mass into the most extreme fire clouds of its sort, known as pyrocumulonimbus. Such clouds, which occur when heat rises from a wildfire, can cause hail, lightning, and tornadoes that can in themselves be extremely dangerous on the ground. The Weather Service said the cloud pattern was terrifying in its own right and asked the public to send positive thoughts and well wishes to the firefighters right now. It's a tough time for them. Fatigue has already started to set in for the first responders battling blazes, and this is just the beginning of a fire season expected to get worse in the coming months. The University of California at Los Angeles public health professor David Eisenman in a statement said, "We're talking about a new kind of fire season, with repeated and persistent fire producing weeks and months of smoke," noting that the compounding disasters will take a mental toll on residents as well. David Eisenman added, "Weeks at a time, most people are resilient, but if it happens for a few months every summer, there's a different story. And months of smoke are the new thing that we're going to see."
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
June 28, 2021, on the occasion of the National Judiciary Week and the martyrdom anniversary of Ayatollah Martyr Beheshti and other personalities. The importance of combating corruption in the judiciary branch and protecting the reputation of honorable judges. You should not say, "No, we know him. The report is not correct." You should not act like this. You must dispatch a vigilant investigation team. This is one of those conditions where you should take the reports seriously. I think it was in the previous term. I do not correctly remember if this happened at the time of Mr. Raisi or in the previous term, when they put together a team which would secretly visit courts of law in provincial cities and would keep things under surveillance. This is a very good course of action. You should mobilize and dispatch individuals to verify the matter and to see how much this claim is true or not. After all, seeing with one's own eyes is very effective. On paper, many things cannot be understood. Unfortunately, these days I cannot have much contact with the people. But for many years, I always had a lot of contact with people. I witnessed things that are only understood in public meetings and in direct contacts. Things that cannot be understood on paper and by reading reports and the like. The judiciary branch should be in close contact with people and with active groups in society. The next point is about presence among the people, a point that I just mentioned. One of Mr. Raisi's strong points in the judiciary branch was presence among the people. You should not stop doing this. The honorable officials in the judiciary branch should not stop doing this after his departure. This is a very good and important course of action, and as I mentioned earlier, it will yield many blessings. Being among the people and being in contact with active groups in society, such as academic, seminary, and economic activists, and activists working on matters related to women and the ones working on tribal matters, being in contact with them is very important. It is very important that judiciary officials, especially the head of the judiciary, be in contact with the groups that work in these fields. There is so much in the field of production that one cannot understand until one has contacted and heard from the people. who are active in the issues of production, such as officials in charge of labor issues and laborers themselves. Communication with these active groups is part of popular presence and public communication, and therefore we must pay attention to it.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Around the world with reporters.
Israel has advanced a major settler building project known as E1. Israel's new prime minister, Naftali Bennett, has relaunched the controversial project for the construction of over 3,412 settler units in the occupied West Bank to connect the largest Israeli settlement of Ma'ale Adumim to the West Jerusalem Al-Quds. The project was first pushed forward by former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Palestinians have slammed the move as seriously dangerous.
Now, as Bennett brings it on the table, it is just to show the settlers that he's better than Netanyahu. He's continued the main strategy and the ideology of the settlements in the West Bank. Netanyahu has been freezing or a little bit slowed down the working in the E1, but they are now pushing it forward. This is a very dangerous colonial project in the West Bank. This will be totally cut off and divided the West Bank between the north and the south. So it's very sensitive, very strategic.
Israeli authorities have been seeking to expel tens of thousands of Palestinian Bedouins to other Palestinian towns since long time ago because the area has been allocated to E1 settlement constructions. This area sits on roughly 15 square kilometers of land northeast of Jerusalem Al-Quds. For years, the Israeli regime has tried to dismantle the Bedouin communities to make way for its massive E1 settlement project in East Jerusalem Al-Quds. The planned Israeli building in E1 would effectively cut the West Bank in half and prevent Palestinian sovereign contiguity between northern and southern West Bank.
The project comes in line with Israel's annexation plan. The new regime in Israel is seeking to disrupt any territorial integrity of a future Palestinian state based on the 1967 borders. To this end, it displaces more Palestinians in violation of all international laws.
Palestinians say that it's very clear that Bennett is even worse than Netanyahu, as he started rapidly to carry out his agenda to expand illegal settlements in the occupied territories even more vigorously. During Netanyahu's term in office, Israeli-only roads were built as first step in constructing settlements in the controversial E1 zone. Now Bennett has revived the plan and the actual construction for E1. Palestinians warned this project would practically cut the occupied West Bank in half. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
South Africa has been in utter chaos since last Thursday, a day after former President Jacob Zuma handed himself into authorities to serve a 15-month jail term. Zuma was convicted of contempt of court after it defied an order to testify before a judicial commission probing allegations of fraud during his years in office. The former leader's imprisonment sparked protests across much of South Africa. The unrest soon escalated into mayhem. In the past 7 days, more than 800 retail shops and over 200 shopping malls have been looted. Government estimates suggest hundreds of millions of dollars of goods have been purloined or destroyed. That has sparked fears of a looming humanitarian crisis, with authorities warning that parts of South Africa may soon be running short of basic provisions. Analysts believe this could be a further blow to the nation's economy already reeling from the coronavirus pandemic.
What could come out of this, of course, would be even further economic crises in South Africa amid this COVID-19 third wave, which has impacted South Africa more than any other country on the African continent.
The South African Army has already deployed thousands of troops to help overstretched police restore order. That proving insufficient, the government has called another 25,000 Army Reserve troops to tackle the emergency. In addition, people in areas worst hit by the violence have taken up arms and formed vigilante groups to protect their neighborhoods. South Africa is experiencing one of its worst crises since the end of apartheid regime in early 1990s. With the former president in prison, high unemployment, and much of the country plagued by crime, it is hard to imagine an easy path back to normalcy.
South Korea has been hit hard by a fourth wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, with new daily cases over 1,000 for the past week. More than 50% of the recent new cases have been the more contagious Delta variant. The government has issued a number of restrictions and guidelines, including banning gatherings of more than two people, other than family, after 6 p.m.
Please refrain from going out or holding social gatherings and abide by the disinfection guidelines wherever you are. Even if you don't have symptoms, please protect yourself and your loved ones by getting tested. We can and must overcome this crisis. The government will do its best.
Bae Hyung-won and his wife operate a small seafood restaurant in Incheon, just outside of Seoul. He diligently disinfects his restaurant, adhering to social distancing protocols and other government guidelines. He says a lot of businesses in the neighborhood are just hanging on.
The current situation is affecting us tremendously. Up to now, the first to third waves of the coronavirus weren't so bad. But as soon as the fourth wave started, from the first day, the number of customers plunged by 80 to 90%.
As many countries around the world are now opening up, South Korea is under more pressure from a restive public to respond more effectively to the outbreak. Young people have been especially critical, as they will wait months for their shots amid shortages of vaccine supplies. The South Korean government had set a goal of November to achieve herd immunity. Currently, about 12% of the population has been fully vaccinated, while health officials emphasize the importance of the next 2 months in containing the recent wave of infections. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In the UK, number 10 has become the centre of a racism controversy which has sharply escalated following England's crushing defeat to Italy in the Euro 2020 football competition.
I just don't support, you know, people participating in, you know, that type of gesture politics to a certain extent as well.
Started after Home Secretary Priti Patel condemned England players for kneeling in solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement in the early stages of the competition. And as fans booed the players' gesture, the Prime Minister, who has been accused of holding racist views himself, refused to condemn fans' behaviour. But now, following England's defeat and intense racist abuse black players have received from fans online, Johnson and Patel have tried to hop aboard the anti-racism bandwagon, a move critics condemn.
It's rather ironic that the government are making these statements today when the Runnymede Trust has just published a report saying that they may be in breach of the UN Convention on Racial Discrimination due to systemic racism in this country. And it's got to be said that the government has facilitated that, I think, with the hostile environment. It's criticism of the Black Lives Matter, dismissing the group as run by Marxists. I think that they've really not covered themselves in glory at all.
Additional embarrassments for number 10 as the Football Association has rejected an invitation to an honorary event that was to be held for the England team outside Downing Street this week.
and also high-profile football personalities have gone on record and publicly condemned the government for allegedly stoking the flames of racism in the UK. But can this fire ever actually be extinguished? That